I want to start today with Matthew's Gospel, Matthew 8, if I can find it myself. You all are familiar with the story that I'm going to refer to. We're going to look at verse 23, Matthew 8, verse 23. Now when he got into a boat, his disciples followed him. And suddenly a great tempest arose on the sea, so that the boat was covered with the waves, but he was asleep. When his disciples came to him and awoke him, saying, "Lord, save us, we are perishing." But he said to them, "Why are you fearful, O you of little faith?" Then he arose, he rebuked the wind and the sea, and there was a great calm. So the men marveled, saying, "Who can this be? Even the winds and the sea obey him." Put yourself for a moment into the disciples' shoes, so to speak. Well, I suppose if we want to be accurate, sandals. They were seasoned fishermen. They were used to the Sea of Galilee's rapid storms that could start. They knew when to head for shore and when not, but this storm terrified them. This storm came with a ferocity that they weren't expecting. And even though they were seasoned veterans of the sea, they had no way of knowing how to deal with this. Their conclusion, we're going to die. This is it. We're too far from land. If we're swept overboard, we'll drown. The boat's about to capsize. We are finished. And then they noticed Jesus in the boat, fast asleep, not a care nor a worry in the world. And we don't know why they woke him, possibly because they thought he'll do something. Or it could have been, you don't want him getting the shock if he hits that water all by himself still asleep. You don't know what went through their minds. All we know is that they woke him. And then we've got to consider his response. He looked up, saw the weather, observed the roughness of the sea. Then he looked at them and he said, "What are you afraid about? Why are you afraid?" If there had been time for an in-depth discussion at this point, they would have said, "Well, we know the danger out there." But there was no time for that. He simply got up, raised a hand, we believe. It doesn't actually say he raised a hand, but we believe he raised a hand, and gave a command. "Be still, be calm." And immediately, the sea was still and the wind calm. And it was as simple as that. And they were amazed at his authority. But he was amazed at their unbelief, their fear, their lack of faith. Here they were in a position where they should have known that as long as he was with them, they were safe. And yet, they just saw the storm. Now apart from that, he's asleep. What good is he if he's asleep? But you see, that was the point. Even though they perceived he was asleep, there was no danger. There never had been any danger to them on that day. And that's the thing that we need to understand about fear. The Bible has a great discussion and a lot to say about fear. There's two different types of fear. There's the fear that is positive, but it's not really what we would in English really call fear. We would call it high respect and honor. A respect for someone's position, a respect for someone's authority over you. In other words, when the Bible says fear God, fear the King, that's what it means. Have authority for it. Respect them. Don't put yourself at odds with them and don't challenge them. But then it also speaks about fearing people. Fearing situations, fearing illness, fearing death. All of these things, God approaches from a different perspective. When I initially thought about speaking about fear, I was thinking of it from the point of myself. I asked myself a question. Why am I afraid? There's things I'm not afraid of. I'll go up on a roof. I'll walk across the roof. I used to do it easily. I'd done it about 2 summers ago and realized, oh, this is high. What's going on here? Still did it. But I was aware now, you know, I'm not as Superman type as I was previously. Before, it wasn't a problem. Now, I'm aware there's differences. So I'm aware of a healthy respect for heights. But I'm not afraid of heights. They don't terrify me. I will go up. I will hold on tight, but I will go up. So when I talk about fear, I had to ask myself, what am I afraid of? And the funny thing was, there is only one thing that I am truly afraid of. And that is losing God. That's it. Losing God. To me, that is the one thing that is unable to replace. What would life be like if you didn't have God in your corner fighting for you? What would it be like if literally you could pray but he wouldn't be listening? Saul, first king of Israel, had a very close relationship with God at the start. At the start of his reign, he was a man who God could work with. He didn't think overly highly of himself. He wasn't worried about his position. But then when he became king for a few years, he began to realize that people looked up to him and he liked people looking up to him. Therefore, he began to make decisions not based on the advice he was getting from Samuel that was coming from God, but rather, he was basing his decisions on how the people viewed him. Political spin, if you like. So, what happened? Samuel said that God has commanded a certain area to be dealt with. Kill everyone. Don't even leave animals alive. Destroy it all. But when Samuel came after the battle, there was bleating of goats and sheep, mooing of cattle. There was young virgin girls that had not been killed. And, to top it all off, the king of the entire place was still alive. Sitting with a wee cup of tea. You know how it is. Immediately the Spirit of God came to Samuel, and Samuel's entire approach to Saul changed. There and then. Because Saul had decided that it would be better not to do what God commanded in case it upset his people. The men with him. They wanted the plunder. They wanted the goods. They wanted the virgins. They wanted to have this for themselves. And not only did he do that, but he also thought it would be better if this king, this foreign king, was taken alive so that he could be put on trial. Interesting. If we look at modern day politics, he was a genius. Saul had a natural ability to govern by our modern standards. But what he didn't have was the ability to govern by God's standards. So God stopped working with him. And that became the hardest thing for Saul to deal with. Initially, he didn't think too much about. Initially, he didn't realize that this was a difficulty. Then, gradually, he realized that he wasn't being told when enemies were coming against him. He wasn't being advised of how to rule or how to deal with this problem or that problem. And also, God had already chosen his replacement, and it wasn't going to be any of his sons. Saul realized he had a problem. When Samuel the prophet finally died, Saul was in such a state, not knowing what to do, not knowing where to turn. He did the ultimate sin, the one thing he would have swore to himself he would never have done. He searched out a medium, a witch, for he wanted the dead raised. Basically, he wanted Samuel raised so that he could have a word with him. Why was this unusual for Saul? Because Saul had pushed this aspect of the false religions out of his land. He had made it a capital offense for anyone to speak to the dead. They were gone. And so when he turned to his officials and he says, "Find me a witch," you know, it wasn't exactly a case of, well, there should be a couple out here down the town a bit. He literally had to think, well, where would there still be a witch that we've missed, that we haven't got? And their spies told him, well, there's still one. She's in Endor. She's a lady in Endor who still has the ability to raise the dead. So he disguised himself, and a few of his officers went with him, and they went to the witch. They talked to her. They said, "I need you to raise somebody for me." And you know what? She agreed. She was aware of the dangers, she was aware of the problems and all the rest, but she was agreed, because she didn't know who it was. But the moment she began to raise the dead, the moment she began the works that she was to do, the spirit that helped work with her told her who it was asking. And this woman nearly had a heart attack on the spot. The king himself, the one who had ordered the destruction of all, had tricked her. He had caught her. And so she accused him. "You tricked me!" But you know what? Her fear was unfounded. He wasn't here to kill her. He was more afraid of what he had lost. He was more afraid of the fact that he was a blind man walking through life, because his eyes, that is God, was gone from him. And so he went to great measures to try and get it back. And we know that what was brought up, and we don't think it was Samuel, what was brought up gave him a message directly from God. "You and your sons will die." And it happened exactly as he was told. And throughout the Bible we find there are different stories of people who have lost things. Esau had been out hunting, very, very hungry. Thought he would die of starvation. Brother was happily making a little porridge of lentils for himself. Sort of a soupy stew, vegetable stew type thing. And he was making this on the fire when his brother came, and the smell, the aroma of it coming across, he says, "Ah, give me some of that. I'm starving. Give me some of that." And his brother, being sly, no, Jacob was sly, said, "I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll sell you some." "Okay, what do you want? What do you want? I'm dying here. Give me some of that stew." "You don't really care too much about the birthright. And we're twins, so it's not a case of a big difference. I want the birthright. Will you sell it to me for this stew?" "Well, what good's a birthright to me if I'm dead?" And immediately, he agreed. He spoke. But what he didn't realize was God was listening. God was listening. It was recorded. The birthright had been given away for a small meal. Jacob gave him the meal. Esau ate the meal. And when he was restored, he thought no more about it. But we all know what happened. When his father was old and wanting to pass the blessing on, he didn't receive it. His brother got it. We might say that his brother stole it, but he didn't. He had bought it. He had paid for it. It was his legally by right. The fact that he deceived his father was simply because his father didn't know about the transaction. But his mother did. And that's why she had supported and helped him. Do you know what the Bible says about that transaction? Esau wept bitter tears for the rest of his life over what he had done. But he could never get it back. He could never restore to himself what he had lost. It was gone. Fear is a terrible thing. And when you lose something, that can be a motivation. But I said there was two aspects of fear. And the second aspect of fear, God does not agree with. He says, no, this should not apply to any of you. I was doing a wee bit of research on the internet, and I thought I'd say to myself, why do they get afraid about witnessing about Jesus Christ? I thought to myself, you know, this would be an interesting question. Stick it up on the internet and see what I come up with. I came back with a couple of things, and I'd like to share with you some of them. Here are 12 things that people have been afraid about with regard to simply talking or witnessing about Jesus Christ. The first is the fear of rejection. So as we go through these, let's put ourselves in these shoes. Are any of these affecting us? Are we afraid of being rejected by the local community if we tell them about Jesus Christ? If we tell them about who we are and what we do? Maybe it's the second one. The fear of ridicule. Well, how can I put this? We're a strange group of Christians that meet on a Saturday. We're already being ridiculed, so why are we afraid of that? It's silly. But then the next one might be more apparent. A fear of failure. What if we aren't listened to? What if there is no response to our evangelical outreach? Of course, some people might have number four, the fear of physical injury. You know, you could go into the wrong place at the wrong time, say the wrong thing, and somebody hits you a slap or something. Maybe a bat. But then again, maybe more people would be affected by number five, the fear of loss of friendships. When a person becomes a Christian, the people in this world who had been their friends, who had gone through the same things as them, suddenly get a little cold and distant, and that can be very off-putting for Christians. It can be very difficult to realize that you're swimming upstream while they're still being carried by the current downstream. Some people, however, who have been Christians for a long time might have more effect with number six. It's the fear of not knowing what to say. It's always a problem. We say, oh, I wouldn't know how to approach it. I wouldn't know what to say to a person. If they asked me a question, I'd have to pass them on to the pastor or the minister or somebody, because I wouldn't know what to say. And yet, you are the people who are trained what to say. You know Scripture. You can answer these questions. And apart from that, you have somebody with you who tells you what to say at every point. What about seven? The fear of not knowing how a person will respond to you. You might say, well, that must be like getting injured, isn't it? But not quite. You see, a person might respond differently. I mean, you might impact on them in such a way where they want to move in with you because you're the source of knowledge. Or they might be going across the other side of the street every time they see you coming. You don't know. So you've got a fear of that. How will they react to you? How about another one which affects a lot of people? I don't know. I'm not sure if it's me. I'm not sure I could do it because they're afraid of doing anything that's new and unknown. Some are just afraid that they won't know how to answer a person's questions if they ask them. Some are afraid, you know, I know this doesn't apply to Northern Ireland. I understand that. And I say that up front, this does not apply to Northern Ireland, but it must happen in other places of the world. They're afraid of intruding into the private lives of others. As I said, not one we would have. But then there's the fear that your fears, your weakness and concerns might also show through, and that might weaken your witness. And the last that I have here in this wee list is, there's a fear that you might say something wrong. That you might put across a message that somebody will try and correct you in because it ain't right to them. You see, there's fears out there for lots of different reasons. But it's not all fear about witnessing. It's fear in our lives. Some people have what they call a phobia. A phobia, by the way, is simply a fancy name. I can't remember if it's Latin or Greek. It's one of the two. For fear. That's what it is. There is one, I forget what it's called now. It's a fear of a person who is publicly speaking. Anybody got that? No. But then there's different fears. People are afraid of enclosed spaces. People are afraid of water. People are afraid of going outside. People are afraid of spiders. People can be afraid of literally anything. But they don't generally allow it to rule their life. If you're afraid, if you've got claustrophobia, that's fear of small spaces, you might not be comfortable going into a large room with a large crowd of people. You might not like the idea of going into a lift at all. The idea of walking into a person's hall, which is small, to go into another door, could terrify you. But it only becomes a problem when it stops you doing the things you need to do. Other than that, you overcome your fear, you close your eyes and you move on. And that's all right. That's acceptable fear. But fear is a problem. And it comes directly from an enemy, Satan. All fear comes from Satan. Because all fear is spiritual at source. And that's the strange thing. When Jesus talked to the disciples and said to them, "Why are you afraid?" they felt justified in being afraid. It was a terrible storm. But he wasn't looking at the physical storm. He was looking at the spirit that was influencing them. He was looking at the fact that they were allowing something to paralyze them with fear and stop them being effective. Stop them in their tracks. People often talk about being frozen to the spot with fear, paralyzed with fear. There's different ways of saying it. But the reality is that that's what happens. Some people get to a stage where fear is so direct in their lives that they freeze. They can't do a thing. They're useless. In the old black and white film days, there was a simple way of dealing with it. Cross the cheek. It got them back to a sense of normality. Or at least got them angry enough to want to hit you back. But it moved them. It got them out of that feared scenario. Now you'd be sued. So don't do that. But you know, fear is a problem. And it's something that God has been addressing with mankind right from the beginning. It's a topic that God covers in the Bible throughout. Nearly every book of the Bible mentions something in regard to fear. But some specialize, like Psalms and Proverbs. So what about fear? How are we to deal with it? What are we supposed to do with it? Well, I want to look at a few scriptures. Now, I haven't said that. I've got 12 pages of scriptures about fear here. That's A4 pages. But I'm not going to read them all. I do have a few marked, though, that I do want to read. There is no point trying to turn over and stay up with me on this, because you ain't going to do it. Trust me. In Isaiah 41, verse 10, "Fear not, for I am with you. Be not dismayed, for I am your God. I will strengthen you. I will help you. I will uphold you with my righteous hand." My righteous right hand. That's an Old Testament verse which many take and say that's very, very important for us. That's really, really inspiring. But do we understand what we've just read? The righteous right hand of God is Jesus Christ. The righteous right hand of God is why we should not be afraid. It's why we should not be dismayed, that's anguished, or anxious about things. And it's because God meets our needs at every turnaround. He upholds us. It's one of the things, I mean, I talked at one point earlier about being on roofs, and while I'm not as steady as I was, I still don't have a fear of it. But I have learned to be careful, so now I will take extra care, and sometimes I can tie a strap to me and something solid when I'm up there in case it gets windy. Hold on tight. Well, that's what God has done for us all. He has Jesus Christ as our stay, as our anchor. No matter what comes against us in life, it's Jesus Christ that we can rely on to stop us falling and being destroyed. That's what Isaiah 41:10 is telling us. What about 2 Timothy 1, verse 7? "For God has given us a spirit, not of fear, but of power and love and self-control." God didn't even decide, "Look, I'm just trying to reason with you here." He says, "I'm changing the very spirit within you from a spirit of timidness and fear to a spirit of power and boldness." That's quite a statement. He's changed us from the inside. In 1 John 4, verse 18, "There is no fear in love, but perfect love casts out fear. For fear has to do with punishment. And whoever fears has not been made perfect in love." Fear has to do with punishment. We shouldn't fear because we are not going to be punished. Through Jesus Christ, we are not to be judged. We are being judged now, but we're not going to be judged then. So we should walk with our heads high and speak without fear with regard to God in all things. Because we have been made a promise. We're not going to be held to an account of our witness for Christ. But he will have something to say if we don't have a witness for Christ. That's the difference. Philippians 4:16, "Do not be anxious about anything, but in everything by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known to God." Joshua 1 verse 9 is one that I do like personally. "Have I not commanded, be strong and courageous. Do not be frightened. Do not be dismayed.
for the Lord your God is with you wherever you go.
Do we believe that? Do we really believe that? If we do, what excuse have we to be afraid? What excuse have we to have fear? In Isaiah 43, we read, "Fear not, for I have redeemed you. I have called you by name. You are mine." Jesus said, "Nobody will take you out of his hand." And then he reminded us, "And nobody will take you out of the Father's hand either." And that's where you are. You are mine. You're his.
In Deuteronomy 31 verse 6, "Be strong and courageous. Do not fear or be in dread of them. For it is the Lord your God who goes with you. He will not leave you, nor will he forsake you."
There are others. You can look at them later if you wish.
But I think you get the drift that in Scripture, God has a lot to say about fear. And it's basically, don't be afraid.
But what are we really to be afraid about?
We don't need to be afraid about death.
Because death has already been defeated.
We are promised life eternal through our Lord Jesus Christ.
And you know, if you've got the promise from God, it's money in the bank. It's something that you are sure about. So why fear what no longer applies to you?
You might say, "Well, I fear sickness and disease and problems. I fear losing all my money. I fear losing my house. There might be a recession. Everything might be taken away. I might lose my job."
No.
If necessary, God can command the birds to bring you food. He commands streams out of real rock just to come and give you water. He can change the weather so that you don't need to have to buy oil. He did that one year for me. I'm really pleased with that. I couldn't afford, remember darling, we couldn't afford to actually get oil. And all of a sudden, the weather improved. It improved for 3 months. People were saying, "This is ridiculous. It's not going to get cold." And we didn't need oil. And then when we got the oil, it got cold. But that was all right. God will meet your needs as you need them. And individually. I try to go for a walk on a daily basis. Well, 6 days a week. Sometimes I'm really like out there. I allow myself to be persuaded not to. But at other times, I'll just head out with an umbrella and head on. But most of the time, I'll head off and it looks like it's going to rain. I might take an umbrella and a coat with me. But I'll say to God, "Could that hold off until I get back? I'll be an hour from walking 3 miles, an hour." And I have seen so many times little drops of rain just touching your cheek as I'm about to go in through the door again of the house. And then it rained. God hears our prayers. He hears when we talk to him. Prayer doesn't have to be difficult. It's two friends in open conversation speaking together. That's all it is. And if we can ask God for the little things that make a difference to us, and it can be little things. "Father, I have to pull into this here chemist to collect a prescription. Can I have a parking space?" Person pulls out, you pull in. That's how it works. But likewise, you have to understand that if you have that sort of relationship with God, then there's an expectation of sometime that him saying to you, "William, Billy, Tommy, Morris, Jeff, Pam, Carly, will any of you do this for me? Will any of you go there for me? Will you respond to this for me? Answer that person that question. Talk to that person there." And if our response is, "Oh Lord, no, 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 I couldn't possibly do that. Then what would they think of me? It'd be terrible." Then we might have a wee problem when we ask God for things. He might say, "No, no, 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 I don't think I should be doing that, really. No, I don't think I should." You might say, well, God's not like that. Well, Jesus is the one who said, if you deny me on earth before men, I will deny you in heaven before my Father and the holy angels. As you do, so will be done to you. If we can ask God and expect him to answer our prayers, little or big, then we must understand that we must be prepared to respond to him when he asks things of us. And what does he ask of us? Simply not to deny him. Not to avoid speaking about him. To tell people about this wonderful gift that has been given through Jesus Christ. That's all we're asked to do. It's not complicated. It's not hard. It's not difficult. It won't take up all your time. It involves you speaking. It involves you talking to people. It involves you doing the things that you do on a normal basis. Nothing else. It's not hard. But you do have a problem. It's called fear. But God does not recognize it in you. So stop hiding behind it. It's not real to you. Thank you.